Okay, thank you very much for joining Sutta teaching session. So we are continuing this program on every Wednesday at 7 a.m. Sri Lanka time. And currently we are discussing Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. This is available in Majjhima Nikaya. And I have prepared a little document regarding this, and we were discussing this for a couple of weeks now. Actually, the content of this sutta is quite relevant to our meditation practice, so that is one reason I have selected this. Again, if I just run through the previous sessions, I started with telling that what is the story behind this this sutta, and at one location Venerable Pukkusati was staying at a potter's place, a potter's warehouse. So there Buddha understood that he ordained on behalf of him, but he never met the Buddha, and then Buddha went to meet him, but Venerable Pukkusati couldn't recognize the Buddha, and so he is addressing Buddha as a friend. And he gave permission Buddha also to join with him and to stay night at that potter's warehouse. And then Pukkusati wanted to attain some samadhi because he newly experienced these various absorptions, and so he was quite interested about those and liked to stay blissful. And Buddha too understood that he is not yet ready to listen Dhamma, so Buddha too spent some time in one of his attainments, and then after emerging from the attainment, so Buddha understood that now Venerable Pukkusati is in a position to listen to Dhamma. So then he, rather than telling that I am the Buddha, I am the teacher, so Buddha get the permission from Venerable Pukkusati to preach Dhamma. He is simply asking whether is it okay if I preach you some Dhamma, are you ready to listen to it? And then Venerable Pukkusati says, oh, no problem friend, you may preach Dhamma, I will listen. So this is how the situation going on. Now Buddha explains in various ways what is this so-called man, so-called woman, so-called person, so-called individual. So this is a kind of a very beautiful analysis Buddha is given to this so-called individuality. So one explanation given is this so-called person is six elements. So this is one explanation. Then six bases of contact. That is the other explanation. Then 18 kinds of mental explorations. So that is another explanation. And then this person, in case get on to some practice, so this is very much relevant to the vipassana practice. And if one get on to the vipassana practice, then one can say he is now has established himself on four foundations. That these four foundations are quite different from four satipatthana foundations. That is the four my foundations of mindfulness. But these four foundations are more broader, and Satipatthana is actually part of this foundation, these foundations. And so now Buddha is elaborating what are these four foundations. Now we are on that section, so I'll directly go to that section because there are a lot of things to discuss on those four foundations. So those four foundations are called the foundation of wisdom. So that is one foundation, that is one resolve. The other foundation is the foundation of truth. The other one, the foundation of relinquishment. The other one, foundation of peace. Now, these are the four foundations Buddha is teaching here. And he says, if one establish well on these four foundations and keeping these as one of his resolves, one of his determinations, then one can reach the final goal. So basically Buddha is giving a sort of a direct path, kind of an explanation to attain Nibbana. Now Venerable Pukkusati is fairly a a very good monk. So even though he hasn't yet ordained formally by the Buddha, but he already got the message from the Buddha while he was at his palace, since he was a king. And now he started practicing some concentration meditation, and his mind is fairly firm, fairly concentrated, and he can maintain his mind on a particular subject for quite a long time. So he has that skill already developed. And now to him, Buddha is giving some preaching, which is now directing him towards the vipassana, towards the wisdom side. Now, with respect to wisdom, Buddha says that one should not neglect wisdom. So that is one short advice with respect to wisdom. And with respect to truth, Buddha says one should preserve truth. With respect to relinquishment, Buddha says one has to cultivate relinquishment. With respect to peace, Buddha says one has to train oneself to be in the peace. So these are little further elaboration of these four foundations, and we'll go one by one. So the first foundation, that is the foundation of wisdom. So there are one advices that one should not neglect wisdom. So what are these wisdom aspects? So here again Buddha explains the six elements. So we know we actually went through these six elements. The first element is the earth element, and Buddha is giving a typical 32 parts explanation here. And the first 20 parts of the body, he is telling the majority is of earth element. So he is categorizing body hair, head hair, nails, teeth, skin. Likewise, there are 20 parts. Buddha says these are majority earth element. And on the other hand, there are certain characteristics related to the earth element. And one can recognize the presence of earth element by hardness, roughness, heaviness, softness, smoothness, lightness. So actually these characteristics are not only available in the inside body or the internal body, but these are quite common outside as well. If we consider a house, a car, a rock, so this earth element is quite predominant. So so there we can understand the internal earth element and the external earth element are the same earth element. Earth element doesn't know where it located, where it is positioned. But rather we are imposing certain that information, those labels to earth element, and that's where we get confused. We get the whole thing complicated. So when one develop this meditation, actually when using or contemplating earth element, the presence of earth element again and again, one will understand the internal earth element and the external earth element are the same earth element. There is no much difference. So in that way, one will lose that dichotomy, where internal, external, that duality, one will lose. So basically, one will have a kind of a oneness, where everywhere, the whole physical world consists of these four elements. It's a kind of a combination, kind of a accumulation of four elements. So this is one insight one can gain by practicing this meditation. And on the other hand, Buddha further emphasized that this earth element, whether it is internal or external, that is not mine, not me, and it is not myself. So basically a direct vipassana practice is recommended here. And when one is capable of practicing like this, so the attachment one had related to the earth element, to his body, to his head, to his, say, whatever the components. So all these now going to be diluted, going to be reduced. And ultimately kind of a disenchantment arising this in this yogi's mind, where now he can, rather than being passionate about these things, rather than being lustful about these things, he can be dispassionate about these things. So this is one of the aims of the Buddha's teaching. he's not actually going to kind of subatomic particle level or to very kind of extreme particle level. Rather, he is giving some information, some foundation for us to practice, for us to train our mind, so that the mind will reduce its delusion, mind will reduce its ignorance. So that is the aim. So that's why Buddha here starts with the typical in a kind of a mundane kind of analysis, giving 20 parts for earth element, again 12 parts for water element. So these are quite common, actually. We can easily understand these explanations. And if one contemplate like that again and again, one's attachment to the body will loosen. So, on the other hand, if one has sort of a self-view related to the body, this body belongs to me, this body is mine, this body is me, something like that, then that also going to be reduced, then because one will understand it is not a single unit, rather it's a kind of an accumulation, kind of an assembly of so many parts. So that's why when we are sort of contemplating like that, so the view of compactness going to be reduced, that Ganasanya, the view of compactness going to be reduced. When we are actually grasping, this Ganasanya is quite predominant. This compactness view is quite predominant. Otherwise, it is difficult for us to grasp. Now, when we understand the body has all these various parts, so they are not individually attractive. But when they come together and sort of covered by a skin, and there we easily get deluded. But if we could penetrate the skin and see the inside, then all these components represent fairly an sort of unattractive situation. So there is no much reason for us to attach to it, attach to any of these components, attach to any of these parts. So that's why Buddha is giving kind of a methodology for us to contemplate, so that our grasping, our attachment going to be reduced. Now, similarly, Buddha is giving explanation related to the water element, and then related to the fire element, and again related to the air element. And these are the four typical elements that most of us are familiar with. So these four are actually used for Vipassana meditation, especially when we do Dhatu Manasikara element meditation. These four are the primarily used elements. The presence of these elements can be known with a concentrated mind. Suppose you are practicing Anapanasati for some time, and then you are able to generate necessary amount of concentration, and at that time there are various element characteristics present in the body, and you are able to notice them. Say, for example, some kind of a roughness available, kind of a hardness available, softness available, smoothness available, heaviness available, lightness available, or some kind of say burning effect available, or kind of a movement available. So likewise, different characteristics of these elements could be visible throughout the body, could be experienced throughout the body. So at that time, if our mind is capable, then we can direct our attention to each of these characteristics, and we can distinctly know these characteristics. So that's the idea. So we are supposed to recognize these various characteristics. So it is necessary, because without understanding the presence of these characteristics, we can't actually realize the behavior of these characteristics. We first need to recognize these characteristics, first need to recognize the presence of these characteristics. So then only we can understand, okay, there are earth element, there are fire element, there are water element, there are air element. Because we understand their manifestation, we understand how they behave, we know how earth element will represent itself. Say, for example, whenever hardness, softness, roughness, smoothness, heaviness, these are present, whenever any of these characters are present, we can understand, okay, that is the manifestation of the earth element. Whenever flowing cohesion is available, wherever, say for example, we can recognize the blood flowing, we can recognize the, say, sweating. So all these have that characteristic, kind of a flowing characteristic. And cohesion is there. So that is how the whole body being kept together. Otherwise, the whole body will collapse, disintegrate. The water element helps to bind it to one unit. But when we recognize these characteristics, then we'll understand, okay, this is the function of water element. Water element is present. Similarly, when we can recognize the inhale and exhale, or when the outgoing air is present, or any kind of air present in the bubbles. So that type of, and again the movements of the whole body. And all these are the manifestation of air element. The air element is responsible for these, all these activities. Similarly, if we can recognize kind of a burning effect, kind of a body temperature, suppose we got fever, so the body temperature increases. So this, and again, sort of the aging process happens. Again, the digestion process happens. All these are functions of fire element. So whenever we understand the any of these characteristics, any of these functionalities, we can understand that is the function, that is the activity of the fire element. So likewise, more and more we can understand the presence of these elements. And then we get on to the space element. Actually, space element we typically don't use in Vipassana. But we can understand the presence of a space element, at least logically, at least rationally we can understand. There are various holes, there are various apertures available throughout the body, orifices available, and so that is where the space element is predominant. Similarly, Buddha is taking us now to the consciousness element. So that is where actually we were discussing. Now, consciousness element is quite, one has to have a fair amount of understanding to go through this consciousness element, because so far what we have discussed is, we can say, fairly material, fairly physical. But now we are stepping into the mental world. And here Buddha is giving the explanation of consciousness with respect to one of its functions. So one of the important functions of the consciousness is to distinctly recognize various parts or various qualities. Now here Buddha is taking the distinct recognition of various feeling tones. Whenever there is a pleasure, one can understand, okay, this is pleasure. When there is pain, one can understand this is pain. When there is neither painful nor happy, nor pleasant, so that is the equanimous, that also can be understood. So this distinct recognition of various feelings is one of the functionality, one of the function of consciousness. So whenever we understand various feelings, very distinctly we can understand, okay, I have a itching, this is little uneasy, little resistance is there. Okay, I have some blissful feeling, some floating kind of experience. Yeah, this is very, very beautiful, very pleasant. So likewise, we have different feeling tones throughout the day. So every time we are going through any of these feelings, mostly it may be equanimous, but we can recognize that. So that recognition, that part of recognition is the function of consciousness. And here Buddha is taking us to how these various feelings are arising. So here Buddha is telling they are arising due to various contact. When there's a contact which is conducive of producing pleasurable feeling, that contact will going to produce pleasurable feeling. When there is a feeling which is capable of producing painful feeling, then the painful feeling arises. When there is a contact which is capable of producing neither painful nor pleasant feeling, then neither painful nor pleasant feeling arise. So likewise, Buddha is emphasizing here the dependent origination, Patissamuppada, because the feeling is a conditioned phenomena. It cannot arise by itself. So there are various other causes conditioning it. There are various other causes making it, producing it. So one of the important such cause is the contact, spassa. So that also we went through last time, and I given some insights with respect to Satipatthana Sutta in Vedana Anupassana. When one can recognize when there is the presence of painful feeling, one can recognize, okay, there is a painful feeling. When there is pleasant feeling, one can understand, okay, there is a pleasant feeling. When there is equanimous feeling, one can recognize there is an equanimous feeling. So now one is looking at various feelings objectively rather than identifying with them, rather than considering them me or my mind or myself. Now one can recognize these various feelings objectively. That is most important part. So as a result, one can assume that one is contemplating like this internally, and he can apply the same scenario outside. Someone else is going through the similar recognition, so one can inferentially one can understand the external behavior, and therefore if one can apply this presence of feelings to inside and outside, I mean these feelings are in a way doesn't know whether they are arising in a human body or animal body or man's a male body or female body. They are merely feelings. So we will lose that internal external dichotomy. So this is another aspect of Vedana Anupassana, where one will reduce one's grasping, because we get grasp because we are giving more emphasis onto the internal feelings. But when we'll understand the internal feelings and the external feelings are merely the feelings, and we can look at them objectively and we can understand their behavior, there is nothing to grasp. The grasping will reduce. As a result, one can understand how they are arising, how they are passing away, how transient they are. So all this one can understand. So as a result, various insights can arise. Keeping feelings as the subject, and one will understand, okay, nothing is worthy of attaching, so these feelings are merely conditioned phenomena. I have no control over them, and they are quite transient, impermanent, so the one's attachment towards feelings will loosen. So one's grasping towards feelings will loose. So, as a result, one's mind can be free. One's mind can be detached. So that is the sort of highlighted here. One can live independently, or the mind can live independently without clinging to anything in the world. So this is actually this far we discussed last time. Actually, I can't immediately come to the today's topic. That's why I have to rush through the last sutta teaching. So with respect to feelings, therefore one can come to a very equanimous situation, because one is not grasping pleasurable feelings, one is not getting angry with various painful feelings, one is not getting deluded by equanimous feelings. One can understand the presence of all these types of feelings. One's grasping will be reduced. One will understand the behavior of any of these feelings. As a result, one's wisdom going to develop. As a result, one's grasping will reduce and one's mind become free. So this free mind is quite equanimous. It is neither pleasurable, neither painful. It's mostly it is equanimous. Now Buddha is explaining Venerable Pukkusati more details or more possibilities what one can do with this equanimity. So Buddha is telling this equanimity. Now he has given up, let go of all the other pleasurable and painful feelings. Now most predominant feeling tone is the equanimous feeling. And now one has gone through a fair amount of practice, and as a result, one's mind has become quite bright, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. Now the mind has fairly purified at this state. It does not mean that one has attained Nibbana or one has completely purified one's mind, but temporarily, as a result of this continuous practice, one's mind become malleable. One's mind become wieldy, one's mind become radiant. Because the impurities have reduced, all the various other defilements have subsided. As a result, the remaining situation is quite radiant. Remaining situation is quite pure. That's why Pabbasaramidam Bhikkhave Cittam, that the original, the primordial level or the state of mind is fairly pure, fairly radiant. So one would be able to recognize that radiant, pure, free, independent nature of the mind. And Buddha is giving a beautiful simile here, telling a simile of a goldsmith, how he is purifying gold. So he is either goldsmith or his apprentice prepare a furnace and then heat up the crucible and take some gold and put it there, and he is now increasing the heat. He time to time blow to it, and time to time sprinkle water, time to time just look on, because everything is happening smoothly. So likewise, he is now properly managing the heat. He's maintaining the heat, which is necessary for the gold to melt. And ultimately, he can remove all the dirt, waste inside the gold, which is mixed with the gold, and he can get pure gold. So this gold become fairly refined now, and well refined, completely refined, and rid of waste, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. Now this is a kind of a process. So if one is come across some gold sand. So there are certain countries, they have those, and that has to be purified. I mean, it is not that a pure gold one can get, but this sand, this soil has to be go through certain process, kind of a purification process, then only one can get the pure gold. So it's a kind of a process, it's a kind of a ongoing activity that one has to properly maintain the heat, properly do various other activities. And as a result, ultimately, one can get some refined, very pure, and malleable, radiant, wieldy gold. Similarly, here to our mind. So, mind also, when one practice properly, would become malleable, pure, wieldy, equanimous, spacious, and free from defilements. Like gold become free from waste. Various dirt, now the mind also become free from various defilements. It may be temporary, doesn't matter, but now the necessary condition is prepared. The mind has taken to the necessary purification so that one can further remove the impurities. The necessary malleability is available. One can mold it as one wish. Now Buddha now emphasize Venerable Pukkusati, how to properly use this equanimity. Now the mind has become malleable and wieldy, and how one can utilize it properly, how one can get the maximum benefit of such a mind. Because it is a kind of a difficult process that one has gone through. A lot of effort being used, a lot of time has invested, and as a result, one would be able to get a very malleable, wieldy, efficient, radiant, pure mind. Now, how one can further refine it or further remove, purify this mind? How one can mold it so that it would be more beneficial? And this is the argument now Buddha is telling here. Now, here Buddha is explaining that if this equanimity is guided towards the sort of arupa jhana, then one can stay there for long, long time. So if I were to direct this equanimity, so purified and bright, to the base of infinite space, and to develop the mind accordingly. So this is where Buddha is giving sort of a perspective about arupa jhana, because this whenever Pukkusati seems to be little fond of jhana, because he is now experiencing them, enjoying them. He likes to be in the blissful state. Now Buddha is giving us the consequences or the disadvantages of these jhanas. So if now here Buddha is telling, if that equanimity which is already generated would be further cultivated towards the arupa jhana, one can, as a result, one can stay in those arupa jhana for many eons of time. But still it is sankata, it is conditioned. One day that power will reduce, and ultimately one may come back even to the human realm, even to the celestial realm, and even to the hell realm. So therefore, one is not totally liberated, one is not totally free from the samsara. Even though for several eons one would be in that immaterial world, arupa jhani brahma realm, but still it is conditioned. So this is one disadvantage that Buddha is emphasizing here. And as a result, Buddha is sort of guiding Venerable Pukkusati not to make any kind of a condition, not to condition his mind. Now, whenever we are sort of absorbed into any of these arupa jhana or any rupa jhana, we actually have to condition the mind. We actually have to color our mind. We actually have to absorb with that state. So the mind become colored, mind become conditioned according to that state. So that conditioned, colored mind is not free. So this is one subtle point we need to understand. Whenever mind is attached with something, mind get all the qualities of that object. Therefore, mind is not free. Mind is subjected to the qualities of that object, attached object. So if we want to completely liberate the mind, completely free our mind, so then we need to recognize kind of a state which is free from any of these attachments, free from any of these graspings, free from any of these conditioning. So Buddha therefore is emphasizing here, now try to maintain the mind unconditioned, without conditioning it. And now don't make any volition. So either to go sort of to another state or to refuse the existing state. So these are very subtle, very refined vipassana techniques Buddha is teaching here, where when one's mind is fairly pure and equanimous, there's a possibility of further conditioning it with various jhana. But that is not the point. Rather, try to keep it still independent, completely free, without getting conditioned, without coloring it, without making it biased. Allow the mind to be free. So this is one important point, how Buddha is turning our mind towards Nibbana. And then don't cling to anything in the world. Nacha kinchi loki upadhyati, na kinchi loki upadhyati. So there is nothing worthy of attaching, nothing worthy of grasping. So don't attach to anything, don't cling to anything. So Buddha is actually very beautifully advising Venerable Bhukkhusathi how the mind can be turned towards the Nibbana, turned towards the unconditioned. When he does not cling, he is not agitated. Because whenever we cling to something, then if that object become trembled, if that object is subjected to any kind of a change, any kind of an impermanence, then our mind also get going to be suffered. Because mind is quite dependent on that subject, dependent on that object. So as a result, Buddha is telling, don't go and attached with anything. Keep the mind totally free. Keep the mind totally independent. If such independent mind is kept, if such independent mind is maintained, so there is no possibility for agitation. So therefore Buddha is telling, when he does not cling, he is not agitated. When he is not agitated, he personally attains Nibbana. So this, now the mind is fairly peaceful, no agitation, no grasping, quite independent, quite free. So there one is turning one's mind towards Nibbana. So this is a very beautiful explanation Buddha is giving in this Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, how one can give up jhana and turn one's attention towards Nibbana. Because jhana or any other concentration practice, that blissful practice, is not the end. Still our mind is conditioned. Still our mind is colored when that mind associates such a beautiful jhanic sort of a situation. But rather Buddha is telling, don't just attach to any of these conditioned phenomena. Don't let your mind governed by those external situations, external phenomena. Rather keep the mind entirely free. Keep the mind entirely free from grasping, free from any attachment, free from any association. So that is where Buddha is directing us towards the unconditioned, towards the Nibbana. And then Buddha is explaining that when one sort of touches the unconditioned, when one is able to attain Nibbana, how one's perspective towards feeling is going to be changed. Actually, this information is still valid for the typical Vedana Anupassana to some extent. So Buddha is explaining how one will understand about feelings when one's mind is capable of recognizing that unconditioned phenomena, that unconditioned or the unattached state of mind. So there Buddha is telling, when one is going through some pleasant feeling, suppose the body is going through some pleasant feeling, then one will understand it is impermanent. Sa anicchati pajanati. And one will understand that he is not holding it, he is not grasping it. Anajyositati pajanati. He is not going into it. And there is no delight in it. One is not going and attaching and trying to be happy and trying to make it more and trying to keep it more. There is no that kind of a delight. Anabhinanditati pajanati. And he is able to go through that pleasurable feeling quite detached. So there's a kind of a distance being generated between this pleasurable feeling and one's observing mind. So this detachment, this disassociation is going to be further and further improved as one's practice is going to be improved. So that is what Buddha is telling here. So when one further practices, after recognizing that unconditioned, after recognizing that state of mind which is free from any attachment, free from any grasping, so one further will practice, maybe Vedana Anupassana, doesn't matter, but now one's mind will recognize all these feelings as impermanent, transient. So as a result, one is not going to grasp them. And one is not going to be elated because one is going through some pleasurable feeling. because those are quite transient, those are quite impermanent, only for a temporary period. And therefore, one is able to go through that present state while maintaining a detached mind. Similarly, Buddha explains about the painful feelings. Suppose now you are going through a painful feeling. Buddha says, now if you are properly looking at it objectively, then this detachment can be generated. This detachment can be improved. One will understand even that painful feeling is transient, even that painful feeling is impermanent, and no point of holding it. And that is sort of there is no point of being angry with it, going to have a resentment towards it. Rather, one would be able to maintain kind of a distance so that one is fairly detached from this painful feeling. Similarly, when one is going through equanimous feeling, rather than simply being ignorant about it, one know, okay, if necessary, one can understand, okay, there are equanimous feeling, but still one can maintain kind of a disassociated or detached state of mind. So this is how he is further improving his Vedanupassana, and now Buddha is talking about his final stage. Now this yogi may be an arahant or maybe a noble person now. Now how this noble person is going through his death. Now Buddha is explaining that. Buddha says here, when he feels a feeling terminating with the body, he understand now there is a feeling which is terminating with the body. So he is, because already his mind is detached, already his mind is disassociated, unassociated. And when he understand that now the body is going through a feeling which is terminating the life. Now this may be in the deathbed. This is the last moment. But he is quite mindful, quite vigilant, diligent, and he will understand, okay, there is a feeling I am experiencing. This will terminate the life. And when the body going to die after the death, since there is no grasping to this feeling, there is no grasping, no sort of delighted any of these, so the whole thing going to calm down, the whole thing going to be cooled down. So there's a beautiful simile giving here, Buddha. So with that, actually, we can properly match this situation with our life. So Buddha is giving a simile of an oil lamp. When an oil lamp is burnt, so if the wick is expired, the oil lamp going to extinguish. And if the oil is expired, then again the oil lamp going to extinguish. So similarly, Buddha says, just as an oil lamp burns in dependence on oil, in dependence on wick, and when the oil and wick are used, then there is no further fuel, there is nothing to burn, and it is now going to no with no fuel. So as a result, the whole oil lamp extinguish, because the conditioning causes, the raw material are no more available. As a result, the oil lamp extinguish. So similarly, Buddha says, so this person, after understanding this so beautiful wisdom, so supreme wisdom, his whole sansaric journey going to be finished. He basically attained Nibbana. He basically attained an arahantship. So his and like a burning candle, like a burning oil lamp, totally extinguish because of running short of oil or running out of wick. Similarly, after this arahant, also passes away, attain Nibbana. So this Buddha says is the supreme kind of wisdom, which is completely capable of destructing the whole delusion, the destructing of whole suffering. So this is the end of the wisdom part. So Buddha says, so don't neglect this part. Don't be sort of negligent, or don't delay in developing this part. So that is the first foremost advice Buddha is giving with respect to wisdom. One should not neglect wisdom. So this is the point. So we need to understand all this theoretically, doesn't matter, but we need to practice according to this information. So if one is able to practice this, then one would be able to have at least some insights what we have discussed so far in this with respect to this sutta. So I think with that I can conclude today's sutta teaching, and I open the session for questions now.
Thank you, Bhante. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And for all friends on the call, if you wish to ask a question, feel free to raise your hand and ask directly, or you can also send them through the chat to me directly. So Bhante, there's one question so far. The question is, there's the possibility of developing too deep of jhana and getting stuck in jhana, making the arising of vipassana difficult. How do we know that we have reached the point in which that is too and negatively impact practice?
Yeah, Jennifer, I couldn't catch your last part. Can you repeat the question?
Sure. So the question is, there is the possibility of developing too deep of jhana and getting stuck in jhana and not giving rise to vipassana. So the question is, how can we know we are stuck in jhana and or clinging to it? And then how can we avoid this and or turn the mind towards the vipassana practice?
Yeah, sure. So basically, I mean, one will attach to it. So suppose you are already attained first jhana. So this, it is beautiful. I mean, it is blissful. So it has the pleasure. It has the, because the first jhana has five jhana factors. Those vitakka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata. The applied mind, the sustained mind, the rapture, and the kind of a happiness, and the concentration, ekagata, one-pointedness. So these factors are present there. So the mind is somewhat elated. Mind becomes somewhat blissful. So this is so beautiful, so attractive. So one can easily get attached to this state. So if one can understand that there is an attachment towards that, so actually one has to come back to oneself, and one has to honestly recognize this attachment towards this state. Suppose you are simply sitting in order to attain that blissful state, because it is so pleasant, so blissful. You can easily escape from this hectic world and be in that state. So you have some kind of a trend of escaping from the world. You have some kind of a resentment towards the world, because you already experience very beautiful, very blissful state of mind. So one is using it as an escapism, and one is using it as a technique to cut off the world and be in there. And one, you are finding a very secluded place, a very silent place. You are sitting there, so the mind becomes very blissful, very attractive, and you are like floating. So you are sitting expecting this kind of a situation. That indicates the mind is attached. You are now fairly attached to that blissful state, and you are meditating in order to attain that blissful state. So if one can honestly understand, now I am not attached to my house or my children or my say car or whatever it is, but I am attached to this blissful state of mind. So this is a very subtle sort of attachment, but one has to honestly understand it. So if one understand, now I have given up this very rough worldly stuff, but now I have already attached to something refined, still it is an attachment. So if one understand it, then that is good. So then one may use it time to time just to energize the mind, doesn't matter, but only to maintain the necessary amount of concentration. I mean, when you are continuing your vipassana, if you have too much concentration, it could be a hindrance towards the vipassana. Because these concentration practices, jhanas, are quite strong. The mind is extremely conditioned by this jhana. And as a result, the possibility of arising defilements is very less. So one can even have wrong understanding that you are already attained Maggapala. Because the mind is so refined, so beautiful, so blissful, there is no even a sign of defilement. Because the mind is so conditioned by the jhana. And therefore one has to give up the jhana and see how the mind behaves. How the mind is now again going back to the lust. How mind again going to be restless. How mind again to be angry. So likewise, we have to, with respect to defilements only, we can understand our situation. So rather than conditioning the mind, therefore we have to be realistic about what is the state of the mind. Now all these jhana are temporarily subsiding the defilements. They are not capable of uprooting defilements. So that is the disadvantage of the jhana. Though they are very beautiful, though they are very blissful, they are sort of temporary state of the mind one can experience in this world. Those are also interesting, I mean, for a typical person, I mean, who is completely sort of going through a lot of bad stuff because of the hectic world. But that is not the ultimate solution. So that we need to clearly understand.
Thank you, Bhante. The next question is, do you mean the feelings arise due to characteristic of elements?
Actually, as I said last time also, this feelings and the material, the rupa, the form, are fairly closely related. Now, suppose you are doing walking meditation, at that time, suppose your foot is touching the ground and you can recognize the hardness, you can recognize the softness, you can maybe recognize the smoothness, you can recognize the heat, you can recognize whether it is cool or hot or whatever it is. So you can recognize these element characteristics. So that is one way of looking at it. But on the other hand, all these characteristics could be equanimous. So they may have the feeling tone as equanimity. So that is another way of looking at it. So now, how are you going to looking at it? I mean, same experience, but you can interpret it in two different ways. Either in the element characteristics way, in the rupakhanda, or in the feelings, in the vedanakhanda. So therefore, it is the way of our perspective. So the entry point is maybe the rupakhanda. Because that may be easy. So one can understand, okay, this is hard, this is soft, this is rough, this is cool, this is hot. So likewise, these different characteristics could be easy to understand. And one can further, as one is further developing, the mind may switch to Vedananupassana and mind may understand the various feeling tones. So that is a kind of a evolvement of the mind. So therefore, I mean, both are available, but one can direct one's mind first into the rupa kanda, first into the element characteristics.
Thank you, Bhante. I'd like to invite Ananda to please ask your question.
Thank you, Deepa. Thank you, Sonana, sir. You know, my question is actually, now, the early part of my meditation practice, you know, I used to get kind of little samadhi and, you know, my mind becomes peaceful and, you know, you can stay there for a long time. Now, due to some reason, maybe because that, you know, we know that, you know, we have to practice vipassana. So we now, I mean, I don't get into the concentration meditation part, samatha bhavana. And so it, normally what I do is, you know, the state of, you know, panchabhavana skandhara and changing, you know, and things like that. But, you know, my problem is now I feel that I'm not settled. You know, when you do vipassana, so when you finish your meditation session, you feel sometimes that, or whether you really did the meditation or not, even, you know, because the mind is wandering between so many things. So what is your advice to that? Is it okay, or I still need to do some samatha at the beginning and then go back to vipassana?
Yeah. Are you able to clearly see the wandering of the mind?
Yeah, okay. I can see. Yeah.
Okay, so I mean, basically that means that you can distinctly understand various types of thoughts arising.
Yes.
Okay, can you look at how they are behaving? I mean, if you can understand those thoughts clearly, one after the other, and they are simply, I mean, say there is a lustful thought arising and then it disappears. There is a sort of a resistance arising and then it disappears. Then there is a, say, sort of jealousy arising and then disappears. Then there is a little a doubt arising and then it disappears. So likewise, if you can recognize these different types of thoughts, then easily the vipassana is developing. Because
yeah, I see actually, you know, I see these changes, I see it is not me, mine, myself, and these are just randomly arising and passing away, and all these things I see, but you know, my problem is that, you know, kind of an inferior feeling that,
yeah,
bro, I don't know whether I'm really doing my meditation because my mind is not in one place, kind of,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Don't worry.
So is it okay, or I need to do something about it?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to tell you. Now, say when you are clearly seeing these different types of thoughts, you are not getting deluded by them. You are not feeding them. As a result, now they become somewhat weak. It is they loosen their impact towards your mind. I mean, they can't govern you. Previously, suppose you are considering them all as true. I have to be responsible to all this. I have to react to all of these. But there is no such delusion now. Now you can look at all these thoughts objectively. As a result, they are going to be weakened. And when they are weakening, there could be a situation that, I mean, this flow will break. There may be, suppose there are 10 thoughts, and after that, there could be a little gap. There may be another 10 thoughts, another little gap, another 5 thoughts, another little gap, another 7 thoughts, another little gap, another 10 thoughts. So likewise, the series now going to have breaks. Can you understand what I'm telling?
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, so that is how now you are finding the space in the mind. So this is where you have to enter towards that spaciousness in the mind. Now we are turning towards another attribute of the mind, because so far we may be thinking, okay, every time mind is occupied, every time mind has some sort of a thought, but that is because not yet we haven't seen that the space of the mind. So when we are able to recognize the space of the mind, then an entirely different sort of orientation going to be arise, entirely different domain going to be open for us. So that openness, that clarity of mind, that spacious of mind, you have to develop. When you are developing that, another kind of concentration arising, and that is very much coming through your vipassana practice, and that going to be more stable, that going to be more peaceful, that going to be more based on the wisdom. It is not kind of a conditioned mind. It is not the kind of a sort of restricted mind. It's a kind of an open mind. It's a kind of a spacious mind. You simply have allowed various thoughts to come, but you are not deluded by them. You simply allow them to pass away, not grasping them. They simply passed away. They came to a kind of a complete cessation. As a result, there's a kind of a resting period in the mind. There's a kind of a gap between those thoughts. As a result, mind going to be more spacious. So that is the sort of turning towards the vipassana. So don't expect sort of a blissful, very rapturous kind of a state of the mind as you got it in the samatha practice. But rather in the vipassana practice, slowly you will take to a kind of a matured kind of a happiness. Because now, say for example, on the other hand, now even if you consider samatha practice, the first jhana is rapturous. But when you are moving towards the second jhana, you have to give up rapture. Because now the mind becomes simply, in the first jhana rapture is present, but the coming and going, the applied mind, vitakka is there. But if you want to refine further, you have to give up vitakka and vichara. Now only the rapture is available. Now if you want to go towards the third jhana, you have to give up rapture as well. Now the kind of a peace is there, kind of a contentment is there. So you need to understand, more our mind is developed, more our mind is refined, now that gross happiness going to be removed and a kind of a refined happiness going to be available. And when you are shifting towards the fourth jhana, you even have to give up the happiness. And the mind will be established on the equanimity. So even in the samatha practice, the improvement happens like this. So particularly in the vipassana practice, so more the mind will be established on equanimity. So therefore don't expect sort of a very blissful kind of a pleasurable state of mind. Rather allow the mind to be sort of equanimous, kind of a balanced, kind of a stable.
Basically, Bhante, it's like a kind of a letting go kind of, or accepting kind of a mind, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bhante.
Yeah.
We have quite a few questions. The next one is, please also explain vipassana jhana in the same context. I feel we are far more alert during vipassana jhana, in that the tendency for attachment is much less.
Yeah, true. Vipassana jhana, actually, different explanations are there. Now, if you refer Sayado U Pandita Bhivansa, he has one of his popular book is the In This Life, In This Very Life. So there he introduces vipassana jhana. So that is where, say, when one is observing various phenomena, how they are arising and passing away, so that state he is telling, okay, it's a kind of a vipassana jhana. So when one is in another state where one is not attached with anything, then he is defining it as another vipassana jhana. So likewise, he has given a sort of a new definition to jhana with respect to vipassana. But on the other hand, if you refer Salayatana Vibhanga Sutta, that is also in Majjhima Nikaya, in the same group of this Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, Buddha is explaining how one can attain jhana through vipassana. So that is, probably I will take that sutta maybe in a later time. That is a very beautiful sutta, where one is developing vipassana and one is now capable of attaining equanimity through various vipassana techniques. But the outcome is the equanimity. So, say for example, one can contemplate various forms and can attain equanimity. One can contemplate various sounds and can attain equanimity. One can contemplate various tastes and can attain equanimity. One can contemplate various feelings, or various contacts, and can attain equanimity. So likewise, different routes are available, different possibilities are available to attain equanimity. So therefore, Buddha says there are what you call the upekkha nanatta nanatta sita. So that is the term given there. This is the equanimity which is which has different aspects. But on the other hand, there's a equanimity which has the kind of a oneness. So that is where Buddha is turning us towards the arupa jhana. Akasananchayatana, vinyananchayatana, akinchanyayatana, where one can establish or step into that arupa jhana level after coming through that practice. So when one makes one's find familiar with that equanimity, which I have explained, coming through various paths, various routes, but the ultimate result is equanimity. When one's mind is recognizing that equanimity, one can easily put one's mind into the equanimity. Instead of going through those practices, after recognizing this equanimity, one can easily keep one's mind on that equanimity. As a result, one can develop arupa jhana. So that actually we can say as vipassana jhana, because the one's approach is entirely different. Even though we can say it is arupa jhana, but actually the route or actually the path, actually the approach is entirely a vipassana approach. So that we can therefore explain as vipassana jhana.
Thank you, Bhante. Next question is, how do you know when to switch to vipassana? How do you know that you have enough concentration?
Yeah, so, I mean, in order to practice vipassana, if you have the, if you can see clearly whatever the bodily phenomena, then that indicates that the necessary amount of concentration is available. Say, for example, you are simply doing a walking meditation and you can clearly see how the leg is touching the ground, how the foot is touching the ground, and you can clearly recognize, okay, this is hardness, this is softness, this is roughness, this is cool, this is cold, this is hot. Likewise, if we can clearly recognize various these characteristics, that indicates the clarity of mind is available. That is enough for vipassana. I mean, the vipassana practice itself further refine the clarity of mind, further refine the concentration. So the necessary amount of concentration depends on how well you can see these phenomena. So if there is no enough concentration available, so these different characteristics you cannot clearly recognize. And on the other hand, While you are trying to recognize them, your mind going to distract, because still the mind is not capable of maintaining on a particular subject. There you can understand, okay, still the concentration is not enough. Say, for example, you are trying to practice walking meditation, but after a couple of recognitions, again mind distracts. Again mind think of various past incidents. Again mind starts kind of a daydreaming. So that means concentration is weak. There you further practice maybe walking meditation, and as a result, this distraction become less and less. So the concentration is improved. As a result, you can for a long time observe various phenomena and their behavior quite clearly.
Thank you, Bhante. Do we have time for two more questions?
Yeah, can.
Okay. Nirosha, I'd like to invite you to please ask your question.
Thank you, Jennifer. This is Nirosha here. Bhante, I have a few questions, actually. Two, three questions. One of these, regarding the air element and the space element. So it's to distinguish this between these two. The air element is what I understand is the element is the element that we breathe, but the space element is the paricheda avakasha. Is that the one that we what we call the space element? Because this, the air element is also in the space element.
No, actually,
is that correct?
Yeah. So basically, air element can be recognized by its functionality. It has the functionality as the movement. So whenever something is moving, so that is the presence of air element. But on the other hand, space doesn't have such functionality. Space is just the, as you said, the sort of a delimiting characteristic. So there are various other sort of elements are there. So the space element simply delimits them. There is no movement or any of those functions with respect to the attributed to the space element.
Which means the space air element is also appearing within the space element.
Yeah, I mean, not only the air element. All the we can
everything. Yes.
We can interpret like all the elements are sort of playing in the space element. Yeah.
But my next question is, when we when one can also go into this Vedanupassana without achieving any of these jhanas, like fourth jhana or anything like that. That's true too, I guess, right?
Yeah.
If I understand this correctly, sometimes when we practice, when we meditate, the mind goes to the certain, observing the mind, we forcefully don't go to that state, but it's automatically
observed.
The mind brings me to that state of mind, and we can clearly see those chaitasika levels and also the vedanas.
Yes.
So when we open up the eyes, you see all this, the whole world. If you be mindful at that time, especially after meditation, you feel like this whole thing that you, especially with these four elements, the air elements or the earth elements, this boundary within myself, the so-called myself, is also dissolved to the earth element and the whole world. For example, I'm in front of the fridge right now, so the fridge becomes myself. And
that's right. I mean, that's what the sort of one
example, like your yes. sound is.
Yeah, so that's what
myself, like, yeah. Oh, it's not myself, or is it myself?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, basically, so those boundaries going to be disappeared now. Those boundaries going to be blurred. So internal, external boundary going to be blurred now. So everywhere, wherever you see, everything appear like elements. That's it. So.
Yeah.
Then where are you going to attach? Now you have loosened the boundaries, you have loosened the lines and the all demarcations, marks, and wherever you see internal or external, you simply see elements. So where are you going to grasp?
Nothing.
Nothing. So that's the point. So Buddha, yeah, I mean, Buddha wants us to sort of arouse this wisdom so that the mind will reduce its grasping, mind become dispassionate. So that is the goal, that is the sort of the direction. So suppose,
for an example,
yeah.
So for an example, if I look at a building,
yeah.
So that building is. Is it yourself or is it not myself or this is myself? It's kind of like
you don't need to basically you don't need to artificially think about like that. Rather when you are continuing your practice, enough wisdom is naturally generated to loosen that self-identity. is not that you are trying, you don't need to impose that wisdom here. Rather, more you understand, I mean, all these internal, external are simply our sort of conventions. It is because we are putting sort of marks, signs, our perceptions. What is available is merely sort of elements. So then it's kind of a question arise. So where is I? Where can I put a self? So this inserting, inserting a self, imposing a identity is a kind of a false interpretation. So this false interpretation, false understanding, going to be dropped. And we understand, okay, because of this sort of the ignorance, we are putting a self identity here. We are putting a wrong label here because of ignorance. Otherwise, simply what is available are all elements. That's it.
Thank you.
It may happen slowly. So it, slowly. Don't think that I am an arahant since I am explaining these things. So basically, we have to continue our practice. Time to time, we may ignorantly go and attach. We may ignorantly go and grasp things. So at that time, we can utilize this wisdom. We can sort of apply this wisdom to release the mind. From this grasping, because we can't immediately have a 100% 24/7 free mind. Free mind. That is impossible. Impossible. But time.
Yeah, as I said, happens like only after meditation, maybe 15 minutes.
So basically, when we recognize that attachment, when we recognize that grasping, there we need to apply wisdom. So that again mind become released, again mind become free.
Good.
Okay. Devansana.
Sadhu.
Okay, then Yanifa, I think we can wind up the session.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining with the Sutta teaching session. Hope I can, we'll meet you again on next Wednesday. So we'll share the merits with traditional verses.